broadcasting live from the land of Israel on thelandofisrael.com. Thank you so much for joining me. We have a great show for you today. Right now, I'm in beautiful Hebron, the roots of the Jewish people, the roots of Israel. And this show is all about the roots. It's about actually people who are trying to uproot our roots. We're going to hear from one of the most incredible and innovative authors of our time, Tuvia Tenenbaum, who I got a chance to sit down with at the Inbal Hotel. And afterwards, of course, how can we have Shabbat without Rabbi Mike Foyer and Spiritual Cafe? So buckle in for a great show, because this one's very special. You're going to hear secrets, you're going to learn things, and you're going to connect, of course, to the land of Israel. So plug in, because here we go.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are, here on thelandofisrael.com. Shalom to you all. And I'm in the beautiful Inbal Hotel, used to be called the La Rome. I'm looking out onto Jerusalem. It is a beautiful day today. There's colors in the sky. I see a church. The Scottish church is across from me. I see the famous Bell Park. And we're at a conference about the Sykes-Picot agreement between the French and the British 100 years ago to try to divide up the whole Middle East. And we're really asking the question of, where is the Middle East today? Within the wonderful amount of speakers that are found, there's also a guest. And this guest is somebody who, as I'm sitting with him here in the lobby of the hotel, people have already stopped him and shaken his hand and have thanked him for his work. He is none other than Tuvia Tenenbaum, who is the author of a book that has made the world stand up and listen. It's called Catch the Jew. And it's put out by Geffen. Even Haaretz, which you would think would be antithetical to this book, calls it a literary sensation. Tuvia Tenenbaum is not the usual suspect. He has written a book called I Sleep in Hitler's Room in German. He is the number one bestseller in Israel of this book, Catch the Jew, a regular columnist for Zeit Online and Forward. He holds advanced degrees in literature and mathematics, and the founder and artistic director of the Jewish Theater of New York. When you hear Tuvia, you're going to hear a combination of a German accent, a little bit of Americana, and a lot of Israel as well. And when you look at Tuvia, let's put it this way, he doesn't look like a regular Israeli, and he could pass for a German tourist or a German or European member of the press corps. And that's what he did when he was writing this book. He went around to organizations that are hateful to Israel. They're antithetical to Israel, and really documented their operations, what they did, and really what I call the narrative warfare. Tuvia, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Yishai, for having me. Thank you, listeners, for listening.
So, Tuvia, I'm coming from Hebron.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Welcome.
I live on the Mount of Olives, but I work in Hebron. Marhaba. And let's put it this way. The most amazing thing is that the roots and the history of the Jewish people in Hebron are almost, it's impossible to doubt them. The history is so rooted, so strong. Our narrative there is so strong, starting from the forefathers and mothers. And yet the jihad has been amazing at undermining that narrative and basically selling the idea that, A, we're not from Hebron or from Israel, and that now that we're here, we are the abusers. That's basically the narrative that we hear. How has the jihad managed to flip the narrative on its head?
Well, I'll correct you in one thing. I think that it's not the jihad. I think that the real culprit here are the Western people, be it Europeans and starting now Americans too. The hatred, the commitment, the passion of the people, non-Muslim I'm talking now about, to hate a Jew is amazing. Is strong, stronger than anything I've seen. They really want to come here, organizations, or pay people money to be here, millions upon millions upon millions, to teach the Arab that the Jews are not to be trusted, that the Jews should not be here, that the Jews do not belong here, and to make it to destabilize the area. I've documented it by simply doing the simplest thing possible to do. Not with a hidden camera, with a crew and a team. Came here, spent months upon months as a German journalist. Did not call myself Tuvia, I call myself Toby, okay? But I am a German journalist, I write for this side, and which is center-left. And everybody respected me, and every NGO wanted me to be with them. and
respected
I show
you,
what you
respected you respected or wanted
me, respected me because I am that German journalist, you know, German journalist.
In other words, you're complicit when you're German central journalist.
Of course, of course. That means that I'll report the way they would expect me to report, of course. You would expect a German to report. So everything was open for me. B'Tselem was open for me. Every organization, Rabbis for Human Rights, everything that you would expect was open for me. And of course, the Palestinian government and the Palestinian people, the Palestinian security, and the Israeli and the Jewish and everything. So what I have seen here was shocking to see. An industry driven by hate, sponsored by millions upon millions upon millions, every year, coming mainly from Europe, but also from America, from United States. And some of it comes from Jews themselves, mostly American Jews, in the color of, for example, New Israel Fund, who pay money for people to catch a Jew doing something wrong and to teach the Arab not to love the Jews. A lot of what you hear the Muslims here saying is almost word for word what they are being taught. I've seen it. I documented it in video, in sound, in everything you want, and in image, in pictures. It's a reality. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. It's absurd.
And it's obsessed.
Total obsession. Total obsession.
Now that's what I wanted
and
to ask you.
And coupled with the Arab imagination, you know, Middle Eastern imagination, it worked perfectly well.
What is the obsession about, Tovia? I sometimes sit
it's
with journalists.
It's a 2,000 years history.
I just want to tell you, I sit with journalists. I sat yesterday with an Italian journalist. First thing, they're always surprised that I am not so excited to speak with them. They almost take offense at the fact that we actually have stopped trusting them and don't think that they're the nicest folks in the world. They don't seem to even understand. Where is that coming from? That's number one. And the other side is, I ask them sometimes, I'm like, what is your obsession about? And I say to them, do you know that in Chicago, since the beginning of 2016, 160 people have been murdered in gang violence, which is a lot more than in the Israel-Palestine conflict. What are you so obsessed about Israel about? Why are you so concerned with this? Why do you spend your time and your money coming here?
I can
here?
Tell you, just for the next book, which is about America, which is the same principle of going, being 6 months in a country, traveling and talking to people, I have seen in America places in one state after the other that you would not see anywhere in this area. I have seen places that the refugee camps in Jordan looked paradise compared to many hoods I've seen in America. Where are the people? In Chicago last year, when I was there, for example, and I interviewed the cops, the police, and they told me they estimated 600 people to die from just shooting.
Gang violence.
And thousands upon thousands of injuries from gunshots.
Okay, so we know about that. We know that a few kilometers away from here, there's a massive mass murder of the Syrian war.
It's not just that. It's not just that. It's state after state after state. You can't count. You lose concentration, starting to count the homeless people just in Hawaii.
Homeless in Hawaii?
In Hawaii. In Seattle. In Washington, D.C. I was shocked to see it. Where are the reports about that?
Mm-hmm.
People are suffering. Yep. And yet those people come here.
The reporters.
They couldn't find anything bad over there. They come here to report something bad over here.
Okay, so
and this is what you're doing. If I take you to South Central LA with pictures, you know, with journalists, and show you how bad it is, and say this is America, this is LA, this is Los Angeles, this is California, I would be correct, because it is. But is it really California? No way. It's just a section of it. Okay? But here they come, they go to the places in each, like in Burin, next to Itzar.
Where?
Burin, next to Itzar.
You know, it's an Arab village?
It's an Arab village, Burin. And they take me to a place, you know, it looks like so horrible. Poverty screams to heaven from every corner. But then, I forced the driver, who was part of Rabbis for Human Rights. I forced the driver, and I told him, listen, I'm German. I'm not a Jew like the rabbis. And you do what I tell you to do, huh? And you drive straight. I'm getting tired of all the poor people. And we continue to drive. More and more. I saw buildings houses, paradise, so beautiful. You don't see it in Savion, in the richest places of your world, whatever the richest places of Israel. You know, you don't see it in Caesarea. You don't see it anywhere. You don't see it in Ranana. It is gorgeous. Where was I? Still? I was still in Burin. But rabbis for human rights do not take journalists to those places.
Right.
They take journalists, like Breaking the Silence, take journalists to Hebron. Where do they take them to Hebron? It's a big city. They take them to an enclave where the Jewish are.
200,000 people live in Hebron.
Yeah, yeah.
And they take them to the Jewish area.
To the Jewish area. And around the Jewish area, there are closed stores, you know, with iron gates, whatever. Looks arable in Shuada Street. Look arable. And then they took it, you know. Look at the Jews, live nice. Look at the Arabs, they're out. Now, let's go out. But wait a second. That area is 3% of the city of Hebron. The city of Hebron is another 97%. What happens in the 97% of the city of Hebron? Well, the journalists don't go there. I went there. On my own, because Breaking the Silence and all the NGOs will not take me there. So I had to go on my own. I can. I am an non-Jew.
Seemingly.
I'm an Aryan German.
Yeah.
And everybody loves me in the Palestinians. I speak Arabic because I'm also. And I saw it. It's one of the richest cities in the Middle East. Beautiful. Restaurants. Full to capacity. Brimming with richness.
Well,
stand on
business.
The street, see the cars driving there. New BMWs, new Lexuses, new Mercedeses, right? And they are not just, you know, the ones from the regime, the corrupt people of the regime. They are the normal person, the normal men and women living in Hebron.
The average.
The average person.
Right.
You don't see a hint of it. I can take you, if you want, to places where the doors of the businesses are locked exactly like in Hebron, next to the where the Jews live. Bethlehem, controlled by the Palestinians. No Jew is allowed. And guess what? Go out of the Nativity Church in that area, and the Peace Center, which is basically a death center. It's like unbelievable what they are doing there. The Peace Center is anti-Semitic, but it's another issue. Go out, go to the beautiful roads over there, or the market used to be. Not the market where they sell vegetables and food. The market where they sell all the nice things. Store after store, wherever you walk, closed, closed, shut down, shut down, shut down, shut down, everything. One store had like, oh, we'll be open from, I don't remember, from June 1st to June 3rd or something in here. Everything is closed.
Why?
Why? Because the Palestinian Authority doesn't care. And they want to bring the tourists to bring them to Nativity Church. And then in the Nativity Church, you're telling me, you know, the Jews, the army, Jesus Israeli, you know what I'm saying? The Jewish army came and he shot inside the Nativity Church, make them all beautiful story, and then let's get out of here. So, the business people, nobody's going there. The Palestinians call it. Nobody's buying anything. Because the idea was to show a bed, what used to be when the Jews were here was so bad, they're shooting all over. So we don't want you to go and buy nice things, you know?
Right.
So, there's no business. And everything is locked. Exactly the same door, the same iron doors, all locked. Not because of Israel.
We're talking with Tovia Tannenbaum, who's the author of To Catch a Jew. It's in Hebrew. It was the number one bestseller in Israel. It's in English. Put out very nicely, by the way, by Geffen, which is an Israeli publishing house. Tovia, when I look at you and I hear your accent and I see your type of glasses and your type of hair, you are also a European person. You're a German. And you're a Jew, but you're German.
Alhamdulillah.
Yeah. Now, you tell me you understand the psyche of these people.
I live with them. I walk with them. I feel it. I hear it all the time. You know, I love it. On Nazis, I sometimes visit Nazis and neo-Nazis, and they come to me and they go to their pubs and all the places, and they say, you know, I can smell a Jew from 5-10 miles away.
Who says this?
You know, the neo-Nazis. And I'm laughing. They're like, really? You can smell? How do you smell a Jew? You know, the Jews all have curled hairs.
The curled
really?
Hairs.
Yeah.
Wait, now,
this has nothing to do with reality, okay? It's not. Obsession is obsession. Now,
I want to get political with you for a second.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about neo-Nazis right now for a second. I'm going to say something weird. I just want your comments on this. Right now, Europe is being, some people would say, invaded by a wave of Islamists. Some people say it's going to be great. There's going to be a merger of those communities. It's going to be okay. Other people say this is kind of the next war. And Europe and Islam have been at war many times. There's been many wars, many victories of Christian Europe that pushed them back. Today, there's no real Christian identity. There's no real ethnic identity in Europe. Islam is coming in. Some people say it's going to work out. Other people say it's not going to work out at all. And then there's this new right-wing movement in Europe, which is feeding off some of that neo-Nazi trend, but it's more about ethnic pride and trying to push back the Islamic kind of onslaught. Where's it all going? Give me a little bit of a snapshot of the European mind.
I mean, I'm not going to join the prophets. According to Judaism, prophecy has been given to the idiots after the destruction of the temple. Maybe I'm an idiot, but I'm trying not to be, so I'll not make any prophecies. At least not to be an idiot in public. At least not to be proven as an idiot. You know, I'll try that. So I cannot tell you what will happen. I can tell you what's going on now. I mean, from Germany you can see, for example, which brought in the most and still bringing in the most of the
quote-unquote
refugees or whatever. It's one very, very interesting thing. Like in Britain, they call them migrants. In Germany, they call them refugees. So you already see the difference.
Right, migrants versus refugees.
Yeah. Right. And in Germany, it's a lot about, as the president of Germany, Gauck, said at the beginning of this year, and he said, we showed what we are really made of, what is inside us. Germany wants to show how great it is. So while the rest of the world is not paying that much attention, at least in the beginning, we are. People are dying, drowning. Europe has ignored it. America ignored it. But we German do not, because you're the good people. So
it's a way of fixing the guilt of the Holocaust? Fixing.
It's not the guilt, the image. Guilt they don't have. Uh-huh. I wish they had guilt. They don't have the guilt. It's the image. It's the image. It's the business. It's the branding. So it's like, guilt, forget it. You're dreaming if you think they're dreaming.
You know, I don't know about
of
the
course,
German
there are
psyche.
There are a few of them. I'm talking about the majority, no guilt at all. So don't like Jews.
By the way, speaking of guilt, I want to just mention, you're also you're a writer, a reporter, but you're also an artist. And that's why it says at the end of your bio here that you're a founder of and artistic director of the Jewish Theater of New York. I recently saw a movie. I was waiting for my wife to see it with me, but she kept on not being willing to see it. And I went and I saw it by myself. When my wife kind of left the house for the day, I watched by myself Son of Saul, about the Sonderkommandos, the people who were putting out the, dealing with the bodies of the Jews in the crematoria, and really the madness that took their minds and the horror behind it. It was an incredible movie, and it laid bare the horrors, not that just the killing, the inhumanity of Nazi Germany. How do people like understand? How do you know? And it's coming out, by the way, it's a Russian and Hungarian movie. Not surprising. It's in Russian and Hungarian. It was shocking to me, but I was happy about it. That again, I was reminded of what really went down, as opposed to what's kind of covered up today. When a movie like that comes out, how does that impact the European psyche?
Okay, I personally did not see the movie. When you talked about the Sonderkommandos, there is the Shoah movie of Claude Lanzmann, which to me is still the best, but I did not see the present movie, the present movie that you are talking about. This doesn't play anymore. This doesn't go anymore.
It's over. That,
it's over. It's right. over.
Right.
You have to understand, and you have to understand one thing. It's unfair to be just only on the Germans. It's not just the Germans. It's the rest of Europe. There used to be, for 2,000 years, this fight, this war, this battle between Christian against Jews, Christian and Jews or whatever. Of course, you know, David and Goliath here. Now, when Europe becomes less and less religious, it did not stop hating the Jew, because there are two elements. It's the religion and it's the culture. The culture is still Christian, even if you don't believe in Jesus. And even if you believe that Jesus did not even exist historically, you still somehow believe that the Jews killed him. don't ask. Explain.
Right.
You know, it's like
meaning to say, just because the real identification with Christianity may have ended, it didn't end the prejudices.
Did not at all. They still think the same. This is what I have documented. To my shocking surprise, because I never believed it, and I sleep in it less soon. Because I always said before that the Germans are great people. I did not know. I mean, and I lived there. But once you start going into the country and talking to people day in and day out, 14, 15, 16 hours a day, and you sit down with them, we talk, and you hear what they see, the common men and women, as they believe that every Israeli Jew, of course, is depressed unless he killed, he murdered, he shot a 10 Palestinian in the morning. They really think so. It's not like, you can't argue this. They really think it. They have to understand one thing. They really don't love the Palestinians. They love the Palestinians as much as you do. Actually, maybe you love them more. You know, they don't like them. Look back a little bit history in Germany. Look back at the Turks, the Turkish people. There are about 4 million Turkish there. How many Germans talk to the Turk? There is no mixing. There is no multicultural. There is nothing. The Turk lives, I move to the other place. I don't want to talk to the Turk. The only thing they got from the Turks is the döner. It's the kebab. That's it. There is never that. You know, they don't love the Turk. He's a Muslim. He's an idiot. They don't love the Arab. They don't trust the Arab. Look at the deal Merkel now did with Erdogan. You know, she promised, she swore over and over she'll never close the gate because people are dying, and this is her obligation, the country's obligation, German obligation, Europe obligation to offer them help and give them life. Now, after a million and some came, she made a deal with Erdogan. Okay, they will die over there. Kill them, you kill them. I didn't see. I mean, it's a joke. It's not human rights that they are after. They don't like them. And why does they like the Palestinian ear? Because the Palestinian ear they can use against the Jew. They teach the Bedouins, for example. Bedouin, tell me for. Okay, yeah, that used to be the desert.
Bedouin are the desert folks, the desert Arabs that live in the south of Israel and some in the north as well.
They sing songs to me and they tell me that the Jews came here and there used to be trees and the Jews took and destroyed all the trees and all the fruits and all this. And I say to them, you know, this Aziz, he sings this song in English, you know, we had our tree, we implanted the trees, you know. It's like, I said to him, Aziz, you hardly speak English. Since when are you such a singer of English, a lyricist? I said, no, it's not mine. Because I said to him, yeah, Aziz, you are in a desert. When were the trees here? When were the apples growing up here, ya Aziz? The oranges grew up here, ya Aziz? Nothing lives here, ya Aziz?
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're here at the Inbal Hotel in the heart of Jerusalem. We have with us the number one best-selling author, Tovia Tenenbaum, the book that has made not just literary sensation, but also really questioning the narrative war that's against the Jews, against Israel, funded not just by the jihad, but also, as Tovia spells out, by the Europeans and now the Americans as well. He's also the author of I Sleep in Hitler's Room, An American Jew Visits Germany. We hear of the very powerful indictment that Tovia speaks about, what Europe is really up to, how they really think, and the endemic anti-Semitism that has never really left. Okay, so let's finish up, Tovia. We're at a conference talking about the instability of the Middle East. The Arab countries are not really countries anymore. They're regions now. They become nomadic and tribal again. Mm. And they're barely what they call Westphalian nation states. Israel continues to survive, and yet it's still under attack by a tremendous amount of forces. There's even Americans that are very much part of the effort to try to delegitimize and undermine Israel. How do you, we talked about no prophecy, but Derech HaTeva, in the way of nature, how do you see it going?
Derech HaTeva is very simple. Again, I'm not making any prophecy. Derech HaTeva is this. I mean, you have the nations of the world who become more and more anti-Semitic, or in other words, let me correct here, are willing to show more and more of their anti-Semitism, because after the Holocaust, it was out of fear to be anti-Semitic. You know, they put people in crematorium. It's not so nice. So, but slowly, 50, 70 years after that, you know, people start feeling it's okay again.
It's okay to come out again.
To come out again, and they come out again. So, and that's not just Germany, it's the rest of it. And it's coming to America, by the way, as I witnessed in the last journeys that I made this year and last year. That's the next book, by the way.
What's the book called? What's the book going to be called? It's not yet out. Okay, it's a trade secret.
Don't quote me.
Okay.
Well, no, Americans. It's like,
don't quote.
I'll tell you
fifth.
Everything. Was just,
That's right. Nobody's
anyway, listening. So it's like Americans are funny. Anyway, so I start hearing already free Palestine, even in Republican states like Montana, like red state. You know,
wow.
So the millennials, you know, the new ones especially, and of course in colleges, and of course like even older people start to hear that, especially in the younger ones. And so this is one thing that happens. The other thing that happens, what I have noticed here in Israel, and it's happening in America as well, American Jewry, minus the Orthodox, there is a huge self-hating that comes out. There is like an unbelievable amount of self-hating, self-loathing, and this passion of commitment of a Jew to point a finger at the rest of the Jews as how bad they are. That they are occupiers, racist, and whatever. You see it here, and you see it sadly also in America. I could not believe what I saw in America and what I heard American Jews saying to me about Judaism and about Israel, as this is the only pariah, that, you know, in the world. I mean, it's like they are
pariah.
Talking war pariah. I mean, yeah, of course. I'm drunk from the coke.
Coca-Cola, folks. He means Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for making it clear.
It's radio.
You know,
people don't see.
Hotel,
don't,
that's yeah, right. Everybody is sitting with the Coke. Yeah, using Coke, yeah, of course. Anyway, so logically enough, look at a person. If everybody hates that person and wants to kill him, and if that person wants to kill himself, what's going to happen when these two personalities, these two characters meet? What will happen is Auschwitz. If you want to die and I want to kill you and we meet in the same room, what will happen?
We can make a deal.
We'll make a deal.
That's right.
And that's what it is.
You're saying Jews are self-hating? And
too many Jews are self-hating.
And on the
and
outside.
It's increasing. The other world is, you know, still hating the Jews. And this is increases, at least publicly, you know, because it was there all the time. The only thing that is changing is in America. That it's becoming now, which was not there before, and it's becoming now. And with this kind of world, mathematically speaking, logically speaking, even if you study on arithmetic 101, you know what the answer is.
All right. Now, Tovia Tenenbaum is, though he speaks doom and gloom, if you know him and you know his personality and you can see his books, there's a smile on his face. There's a lot of humor and laughter in it. And at the end of the day, the Jewish people have survived a lot. And we're going
to
get through this one as well.
There is a trick to it. Not a trick. There is a way out of it.
Yeah.
The problem is that the Jews who love themselves, or the Jews who are proud to be Jews, or let's say conservative Jews in that case, because this is what happened. It used to be that way. But conservative Jews, and conservative in general, understanding Hasbara, do you say Hasbara?
We call it
not propaganda.
Advocacy.
Advocacy, whatever. Understand nothing. Well, the other side understand it very well. On the left of politics, the liberal, or I would call, say it, the so-called liberal, or the so-called progressive liberal, they know how to write, they know how to talk, they come to you dressed so well, so fashionable.
That's right.
And they have nice haircuts.
Always with aesthetics.
And they have nice glasses.
Right.
And they look so good. And they are like skinny, I mean, like, you know, they go to sports, they go to the gym. And then they give you all this stupid thing about Israel, about Jews, you know. It's like Arbo. And then comes the other one who supports Israel. He's a schmendrick. You know, he doesn't know how to talk. He's angry because he's upset. And he starts screaming, hey, you, how can you say this to me? Nobody listens to you.
That's right.
You know, you can't do that. You have to learn how to do that. You want to explain somebody? Explain yourself? You have to be nice. First of all, you have to know how to write because conservatives don't know how to write. It's brainy. It's boring. You can't read it.
Right.
It has to be fluent. It has to go like this, like water. Simple, simple, baby. Simple does it. That's what you. And then you have to be nice. You meet somebody, instead of screaming, oh, I have some vegan sandwich for you. Would you like?
Vegan sandwich.
Vegan sandwich for you. Would you like? You know what I'm saying? And it's such so nice to see you. You look so beautiful. I wish I looked like you. And then you start talking politics. And you start explaining yourself. And all of a sudden you'll see, oh God, he listens to you.
All right, Tovia.
Anti-Semitism is not doomed. You can change it. These books. Both these books are published, the commission of these books are German publisher, is a German publisher. And both these books became Spiegel bestsellers. You know why? Because the first time the German met a Jew, who doesn't say to the German, say, you, bad you.
Right.
Say, you know what, I like you. I am, you know what, you are neurotic, you are German neurotic, and I'm neurotic like you. We like each other. But you know what? You have a disease. It's called anti-Semitism. It's called racism. You still want to kill the Jew. I am not afraid of it. It's not for me. For you, I tell you. My dear German friends, if you continue like this, you kill yourself, not anybody else.
Strong words,
Tovia. And they listen.
Well, I guess that's the breakthrough of Tovia Tannenbaum, that he's been able to get people to listen a little bit to this narrative war that's been happening against the Jews, the deep-rooted anti-Semitism. And within that also...
And I'll give you one example. Catch the Jew.
Within that, you heard also critique a little bit about how nationalists do it as well. And that's something that listeners to this show have to pick up as well.
And that's one more comment. Catch the Jew. When it came out in Israel, Tfos Tayudi. When it came out in Israel, only the right-wing publications praised it. Haaretz tried to kill it. Two articles, which Peck of Lies didn't work out. Then they gave it to the book critic. And guess what? The best review of the book came from Haaretz. The best. And the title was Last Call to the Left.
Wow.
Wake up.
Wow.
You can make a difference.
There you go, folks. Read the books. Catch the Jew, Tovia Tannenbaum. I Sleep in Hitler's Room also. And soon, a new book about American Jewry as well. A little refreshing truth in your face that even with love, with a little bit of a vegan sandwich, that way folks on the other side can accept it as well. Tovia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, listener, for listening. And I hope you listen all the way up to here.
I hope so as well. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, part of the LandOfIsrael.com network, broadcasting live from Jerusalem. Be part of the story. Don't be afraid of anything. Write me an email, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. And shalom.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting on thelandofisrael.com. Thanks so much for being with me. Write me an email, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I hope you enjoyed that talk with Tovia Tannenbaum, really one of the creative and interesting people of our time who's opening it up, opening our eyes, and he's a gift to us and really to everybody who cares about the story of Israel and the future of peace in the Middle East. Right now in beautiful Hebron, the seat, the root of the Jewish presence in the land of Israel, the first purchase of the property of the land of Israel by the Jewish people, by Abraham, the first place where King David had his kingdom. So this is the roots of the Jewish people in this land. And the roots are going to be sustained by the Torah, and that's why the next section is so important to get us ready for Shabbat. How can we even have Shabbat without Spiritual Cafe and Rabbi Mike Foyer? So here we go. I hope you're going to enjoy it. It really is a great segment, a great honor to be with him, and it's a great honor to be with you, and it's a great honor to be broadcasting the story of Israel and to keep you a part of it, because that's exactly what you are, part of a great story. Here's Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it. Wherever you are, shalom and welcome. We are in beautiful Inbal Hotel, one of the premier hotels here in Jerusalem, and one that has kept its status as a premier hotel for a long time. Great place. I remember when it used to be called the...
La Rome.
And that voice right next to me here is Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
This is a luxurious location.
It is a luxurious location, but we're not in such a luxurious kind of moment here. We're over to the side, sitting on some couches, some chairs. And we're doing that because you've graciously, Rabbi Mike, have joined me here at this conference, the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs Conference, on the 100 years since Sykes-Picot and where really the Middle East is heading, given that the Middle East is basically falling apart to pre-European created lines, and only the countries that are the real countries, i.e. Egypt, Israel, maybe Iran, they're the only ones that are kind of sticking around. The other ones are in a big shift, and that's what this conference is about. And this segment of the show, which you so kindly joined me here at the conference, is our regular slot called Spiritual Cafe here on the Yishai Fleischer Show on the LandOfIsrael.com network. Our Torah portion this year, this day, is one of my favorites. It's called Behar, on the mountain. This is the Sermon on the Mount, okay? Yes.
1.0.
That's right. This is the original. By the way, that whole business about calling the Torah the Old Testament. By the way, if you don't know this, we don't really like that term, the Old Testament. We don't like that term. We this is the original Testament and the Eternal Testament. In any case, this Torah portion is one of those that contends for being the most Zionist Torah portion. There's a few of them, and they all get different ribbons. But this one is where we've seen other Torah portions say, "I am Hashem, your God." In this Torah portion, it'll say things like, "I am Hashem, your God, who has given you the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, to be a God unto you." And the rabbis and the commentators jump on that, and they'll say, "You see, God is really our God in the land of Israel. Outside of the land, we're less connected. We're more like, you know," and there's like these strong languages, like it's like idol worship, being outside of the land. Like, this is where it happens. And the reason that this Torah portion is the one that will specify that is because it deals with, really, land of Israel, state laws. Okay, it'll deal with the flagship of Land of Israel laws, which is the sabbatical year. It'll deal with the incredible economic revolutionary concept of leaving the 50th year as not only a sabbatical year, but also as a year where things, ownership goes back to its original ownership, where slaves are freed. Actually, they're freed every 7 years, but this concept of the Jubilee, where things become liberated automatically on this date, where the game is over, the Monopoly game is over, you shake up the pieces and you start again.
Well, you don't exactly shake them up. Everything returns to source. It makes an important distinction to keep people in touch with, because it's, though you use the language of state law, I would say there's actually something more fundamental going on here, because a state is a manifestation of a society, right? And a society in the mind of the Torah is grounded in its land. And in particular, in the divine relationship, which is available only to the wholeness of the society in the wholeness of its land. Right? And that's why the laws of Shemitah, the laws of sabbatical, are linked to the tribes being in their inheritance. Right? And something which is inherited is inherent. Right? It belongs to you in some sense, which is not a matter of ownership, but is a matter of almost of kinship, if you could say such a thing, between land and blood. Right? And so therefore, what happens in the Jubilee is not a shaking up. That's how it functions. It's true. It shakes up whatever sort of sociopolitical structure has manifested itself over the last 50 years of buying, selling, trading, taking, giving, etc. But it returns everything to source. And what that allows you to do, and for me, what this Torah portion so profoundly does by linking Shemitah to Mount Sinai is it gives you a basis on which to build a healthy society.
So exactly what you just mentioned, which is the linkage between the sabbatical year, the Shemitah year, and the Sinaitic experience, is the linkage in this week's Torah portion. And one would really wonder at that. One would say, well, I would have not mentioned Mount Sinai. And specifically, it says these are the laws that Moses got at Mount Sinai, and then go on to talk about the land of Israel. It seems almost like a kind of irony. And immediately, our commentators jump on that and ask, "Well, what is the connection? You know, what is the connection between Mount Sinai and the sabbatical year? Why have that together?"
Which so beautifully becomes an expression in modern Hebrew. Have you ever heard a non-religious Jew say, "My Indian Shemitah are Sinai"? And it's right. Just like, what do these two things have to do with each other? That's right. I'm going to reiterate what I said, which what they have to do with each other is the fact that law in its particulars quickly becomes meaningless without fundamental standards by which to guide them. Every conscious action is an opportunity for law or for behavioral negotiation or values negotiation. You're a lawyer, you know what I'm speaking about, right? But it's to a certain degree meaningless unless there is a standard by which you can judge it. So therefore, the experience of Sinai, like you said, the Sinaitic experience is one. The land as a vessel which expresses both God's blessing and Shalom Neidam Izeh, his punishment, is another, but the sense of what we would today call social justice, that a society in this land is free to buy and sell, is free to pursue wealth and personal interests, and yet it must be founded on a sense of justice and care for each other, that is what basically causes the map to go back to zero every 50 years.
That's interesting. And it is, you agree with me that it's a revolutionary concept.
I'll tell you what's revolutionary about
it. Was there any other religion or idea that had this?
Absolutely. This was actually a common practice amongst the Akkadian kings. Like, you go to the east here, I mean, you got here in this conference, they're all talking about what's happening in the chaos to the east. In the society into which Avraham Avinu was born. Right, or even to Hammurabi's society, which was a contemporary society at the time of the giving of the Torah, there was a well-founded notion that when a king took power, he would relieve debts, or release slaves, or cause a return of land, or if he wanted, he could do
it. That's what I was hoping that Obama would do with some of my college debt.
And people were speaking about it, right? But the difference of the Torah is that those actions were dependent upon the whim, personality, and what we would call real politique of the king. What the Torah says is, no, this is a way to build a righteous society. And it's not going to be bound up with anyone's personal interest. On the contrary, you can imagine it's actually to the detriment of many people's personal interests. And yet, that's only in the narrow sense. Because the other piece, as you mentioned, the difference between the relationship we have with God in the land and out of it, is in many ways, it's the relationship that you have as an individual or as a whole. The relationship with God outside the land of Israel, with some notable exceptions, is an individualistic relationship. Even though there are strong communal structures, it's not God's relationship to Israel as a whole.
Right.
That occurs here.
Right. And what I do when I speak in America or places in the diaspora is I'll stress to them that I do not believe, and I don't think the Torah believes, that exilic Judaism, diaspora Judaism, is illegitimate. It's not illegitimate. It is, in fact, the Torah will talk to you about what life is like Jewishly outside of the land of Israel. It makes all kinds of references to that, and it'll even teach us not how to build a temple, but how to build a tabernacle, which is mobile, which comes with us in the Sinai desert. So it's not that it's illegitimate, but it's a different modality. And certainly one cannot deny that the higher form, the collective conscience that comes together when Jewish people are serving God in the land of Israel, is of it's a different nature. It's a higher nature. It's the nature that we yearn for. And therefore, we're living in a time of great transition between diaspora existence, which is legitimate. And the reason I'm stressing this is because sometimes people would like to kill the messenger by saying, oh, you're saying that we're illegitimate. No, not at all. I'm not saying that Muncie or Teaneck or Toronto or anything like that is or Brooklyn is illegitimate. Not at all. But we are, as a nation, transitioning right now to a higher plane. And we have to kind of accept this reality. We have to be thankful for it on top of it. Not to mention that we have to yearn, strive to make it actually complete and happen.
Amen. I'll tell you a story. They tell about Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, our teacher, Rav Aram Yitzchak Cohen Cook's son, that there was a famous educator from Great Britain, Jew, obviously. He came and he learned at Merkaz Harav at the yeshiva here in Yerushalayim for many years. But he went back. And he went back, and he was a very successful educator and a communal leader. And all his friends here were constantly telling him that you should make Aliyah, you should make Aliyah. And so one year he was here back visiting the yeshiva, and he went to Rav Tzviyuda and asked him, what am I supposed to do, Kavod Rav? Here I am in my native language. I know the culture. I'm succeeding. I'm bringing people closer to Torah, bringing people closer to the land of Israel, being closer to each other. If I come here in Israel, I'm a dime a dozen English teachers of Torah, as I can tell you, are not uncommon. And he said, furthermore, I'll always be an immigrant. So Tzviya says, make Aliyah first, and then I'll answer your question. So he went home. A number of years later, he actually made Aliyah. So he hadn't forgotten. He went back to the Rav, and he asked him, and he said, now you can go on Shlichut. Now you can actually go out into the world and teach in your native language and draw people closer in the way you know how. But he wasn't playing games with him. What was he saying? Is that you have to know where your source is and where your journeys take you. And we've been on a journey for 2,000 years, so much so that many of our brothers and sisters have forgotten that that's what we're doing, right? This idea of coming home is not just some sort of like simplistic, oh, come on home, everything will be fine. It's an identification of source. Just as in Shemitah, everything goes back to source in order that it will take another 50 years and unfold and unravel, etc. But there's a different relationship to the world when you know where your source is.
So we're talking about source, and the Torah portion starts with the mention of the Mount Sinai, and then it goes to talk about Shemitah. The way I explain it to people is that there are oftentimes Jews in the world Torah Jews who start to fall in love with the concept of Torah, and then they poo-poo or minimize the concept of the land of Israel. So the Torah portion comes to tell you, if you want Torah Sinai, that's Shemitah. That's the land of Israel. So therefore, it's a strike against, let's say, communities like Lakewood, which really claim that Torah is superior to all the other values. Comes the Torah in this week's Torah portion says, when you say the word Torah, which is equal to Sinai, the receiving of Torah, that's actually Shemitah. That's when I really, when I want you to think Torah, I want you to think how it's done in the land of Israel. And conversely, there were also Jews who thought the land of Israel is what's important. And I don't need Torah because that will replace it. Zionism, nationalism will replace Torah. Comes the Torah and says to you, when you think about things like Shemitah, which is land of Israel, things that's an agricultural thing, you got to remember Sinai. You got to remember where the source, where your rights come from, why you're there, who gave you this land, what keeps you on the land. And it's the union between Torah and the land. Torah and the land, which is this penultimate union. This is the marriage. This is the phrase that the rabbis use about marriage. Morasha, they say. Morasha in eternal inheritance also means me'orasa. It's married. And really it's the marriage of the Torah and the land and the people. We are the ring. We are the thing that bridges that Torah and the land together because we make Torah happen on the land. We both gain the land by conquering it with God's help, and we keep the Torah on this land. We're the glue. We're the sandwich. We're the stuff in the middle. We're the turkey, okay, in the sub.
So it's beautiful what you're saying, and I would add another layer to it by pointing out that the confusion, I think, between those two groups that you characterize, each which thinks that one can be had to the exclusion of the other, is rooted in actually a more fundamental confusion, which is that neither the Torah nor the land is really the purpose. Each of them are a vessel for a relationship with God. And that relationship, if it's not embodied, like with dirt between your toes type of embodiment, will always be a certain degree at arm's length. But that relationship, if it isn't understood and developed and enriched through the powers that the soul can bring out of the Torah, will always be shallow. Right? So in order to actually have our feet in the dirt and then to root ourselves and therefore have a relationship where we can flower and grow, so you certainly need them both.
I love that word rooting. I think it's really where we're at today. And we have to strengthen that root. Right now we are trying, the forces against us are trying to uproot us or to even tell us, that's not even your root. you're not even here. It's really a mind displacement.
I tell you what, there's an important
mind dispossession.
Don't let it take you. Right. One of the great sources of strength I always look to is the Tanakh, it's the Bible. And you know, there's a classic question. You read the book of Joshua, and everything's going great.
Just parenthetically, yeah? I want to tell you, I met a black woman on Yom Ha'atzmaut, Israel Independence Day. She was wearing an African type clothing, but it was blue and white with embroidered flag of Israel on it. She was wearing a flag of Israel bow, and she was wearing a flag of Israel earrings, and she did it as Africans sometimes do, with such natural flair, but never, it never seemed strange or mm-hmm. or kind of concocted. It was just so natural. She was so cool. I took a picture of her, put it on our Facebook, and you know what she said to me? She says, "I'm not Jewish, but I love Israel because I read scripture." And it was just, you know, sometimes, and I call it the Gentile test or the Goy test. Like the simple things. Mm. Like what is it? Reduce it to simple things. God gave you this land. You're coming back. He's bringing you back to the land like he promised. And this lady was just embodying it. And she wasn't Jewish. She wasn't being redeemed through this. Or maybe she wasn't a grand scale, but
wasn't personal.
Wasn't personal, seemingly. And yet she glowed with the simplicity of being on God's team. I just wanted to say that within what you're saying.
No, thanks for that image.
which is the Tanakh gives us strength.
Yeah, sure. And in this how this word rootedness struck you, and the attempt of our enemies and those around us to unroot us, and we ourselves. And there's a certain part of that unrooting that we own, that like we're shy from it or et cetera. So I always look to the difference between the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. Right, it's quite a striking contrast. In Joshua and Yoshua, the focus, the togetherness of the people, the power of the conquest, how deeply they root themselves in the land so quickly. And then it's sort of like you turn the page
and everything falls apart.
Right.
It's just chaos, you know, and brother fighting brother and invading armies and confusion about values. And so I saw a beautiful shot once, beautiful explanation that said that the spiritual energy it takes to root in the land of Israel reduced the tribes almost to the level of the nations around them. That impact and the rooting was of such a tremendous order that what follows in its wake is a draining. But yet, that root really struck, because what emerges out of the chaos of the Book of Judges is kingship.
Right.
And so if we follow the metaphor through in our day, and to me it's very true that we live in the time of the Judges repeating itself, right? Powerful leaders who lack clarity, who come and go, that relationship between our moral spiritual stature and our political stature. But most of all, it's important to remember that we have struck root, and that what we're trying to do is make space for Malchut to arise.
Kingship. Rabbi Mike, I want to tell you about rootedness. I do this as a little mental exercise sometimes, not even exercise, a way to relax, is as we're sitting right here, I like think of my feet on the soil of Jerusalem. We are right now on the ground floor of this hotel. And I like being on the ground floor sometimes. I like to feel underneath. This is the bedrock of Jerusalem. We're in Yerushalayim. We're talking Torah in Yerushalayim in a beautiful hotel. And there's, you know, it's all happening. Feel the roots coming out of your feet and entering the soil. All right, let's take a tiny break here. You're listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show on thelandofisrael.com. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me here on Spiritual Cafe, weekly segment of the show. Makes my whole week go around. I want to thank a few people. First, I want to thank our good friend Jack, who makes this show happen. He dedicates the show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. His sister Sarah Z has also become a donor to the show, and she helps make it happen. Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you so much, Jack. Now, Jack was one of the people who jumped at the opportunity to get the big flag. He got the big flag. And he's going to be putting it in his bedroom too.
It's an enormous flag.
It's an enormous flag, really. You can do a lot with that flag. And now Andy from Atlanta, who is a great Zionist, not just pro Israel, but a great Zionist, really makes things happen here in the land of Israel. He got the second flag. He donated. He went to yishaifleischer.com/donated and donate. And he nailed it. He got the second flag. And congratulations to you. Thank you very much. And finally, there was another nibble at the third flag. See, there's three size flags. There's the flag on top of the Mount of Olives altogether, the Messianic flag, let's call it. Okay, and that's from the Choshen building that all of Jerusalem sees it. The second flag was on top of my building, very big flag. Andy probably got that one because he's going to choose. But the third flag is the one that was off of my own balcony. So if you love, you know, the Yishai Fleischer connection and the porch, and it looked right onto the Temple Mount, and many holy thoughts came through that flag. That flag, there was a nibble by my good friend Andrew in New York. One second, it says Andy, and then Andrew, my buddy Andrew in New York, and he's actually doing amazing stuff. Do you know what he's helping me do?
What's that?
He's helping me connect to other Hebrons in America to make them sister cities. Okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's right. We're going to go to Hebron, Connecticut. We're going to shake hands with the mayor or whatever the elders and whatever they do over there. And we're going to connect the Hebrons in America to Hebron, the one in Judea, the original. But he nibbled at the third flag. He didn't want it. He wants a Hebron flag. So now I'm in the pursuit of getting a flag that flew in Hebron, maybe even on the Maarat HaMachpelah itself. So I'm working on that. So the third flag is still open. For somebody can get it. There was another nibble of somebody who said they really wanted. They weren't ready to donate yet. Okay, but I said this flag is worth blood. It's worth money. We can't just give it away. You got to give a little blood to the land of Israel to Jerusalem if you want that flag, or to Hebron. So in any case, that flag is still open. I also want to thank the good people at Hebron who let me do this show also as part of the good work that I get a chance to do there. And I want you to check out Hebron.com. Our director general is Uri Karzen. He's a listener to the show, and he's making it happen in Hebron, holding on tight. The heroes of Hebron who put their life on the line to keep that site open. If it wasn't for the heroes of Hebron and the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs would be like the tomb of Joseph, destroyed and with very, very limited access for Jewish people. So yasher koach to all those good people. And finally, we also have a sponsor for the show, Capone Defense. Being a Zionist means farming, means Hebrew, means Torah in the land. It also means self-defense. And Capone Defense, with a K, will teach you how to be an awesome Jew, a Jew that can defend himself and defend others. And there's nothing like that feeling of being a Jew who can defend himself. It just gives us that rooting that we need. And God is proud of us when we can fight. He's proud of us when we can do Torah and fight. So you mentioned a few things, Rabbi Mike, at the onset of the program of Spiritual Cafe. You mentioned this issue of communal sense that comes with the land of Israel. And it should be noted that the Jewish people are always communal, even when outside the land of Israel. In fact, that's what kept us going. But it's a different kind of communal. And in fact, this Torah portion, Behar, which is we're in the book of Leviticus, and it's a book of laws. There's at least three mentions of when your brother becomes financially weakened, your brother, ki yamuch achicha, when your brother's down, what are you going to do for your brother? And I think that's it's a particular language for this week's Torah portion. And so there's a brotherliness that comes out when the Jewish people are in the land of Israel. And also, let's get pragmatic, it's also about some kind of economic framework and system through which we help society, not just the individual, but society and the societal poor rise up. Tell us a little bit about Ki Yamuch Achicha and that societal ability, what the Torah's recommendations are or dictates as to how to actually serve God by helping your brother rise up.
Well, first and foremost, you don't profit off your family. You know, all of the imagery that the Torah uses, not just the imagery, but the legal language, you can take from two perspectives. One is when it comes to capital, you know, cash, which is used for investment in the growth of another, that it's forbidden to lend on interest. Why? Because interest is basically me profiting off of somebody else's sweat and effort, right? Which is not done within a family relationship. With a family relationship, the primary impetus is to help. In fact, it's a mitzvah aseh, a positive commandment, to give interest-free loans to your brother. Because the Torah sees the blessing that I accrue beyond my needs as something I hold basically in trust for the help of others. And that sense of communal help is...
Like you would do for your kids. Like you would give it. You would give your kid. If your kid needed $20,000, you would give him.
Absolutely. And that's the notion, is that there's a value which transcends consumer power.
And there's a mitzvah to give
is
loans?
It separate from the commandment to actually give tzedakah, which is not charity, it's an act of righteousness, but of giving what is called in English charity. Right? There's a separate commandment to take some portion of your money and give it to others as a loan, which means you're going to get it back, but it's interest-free.
Right. Now, one would think, in a Western way of thinking, that you would lose money through that because, you know, money depreciates a little bit with time, and so therefore you're giving away $20,000 that could have been invested. And instead, you're giving it as a free loan, and it's coming back the same amount. All these different thoughts that you may have. But here in Israel, there's a professor named Eliezer Jaffe, who's a religious Jew, I think an American as well. And I've interviewed him. And he was a professor of economics at Hebrew U, and I think he worked for the government for some time. He was an ombudsman. In any case, so he created something, the Hebrew Free Loan Society.
It's the Israel Free Loan Association now.
Israel Free Loan Association. Look it up. And as I interviewed him, I think I might be fudging the numbers a little bit, but he told me that the kitty, the amount of money that they were able to loan out was about $60,000 when they started, and now, and I don't exaggerate at this part, it was about $100 million that they're able to give out yearly in their fiscal cycle. And they're very sophisticated about it, but the bottom line is you get a loan for free and it comes back. And then some people have added this money grow so much because people have wanted to take part in this mitzvah. So they've created like funds as part, as segments of this $100 million that it's in the name of somebody. So there's $100,000 or whatever it is in the name of a certain person, and you just got that person's name loan, and you're going to bring it back. So that person has the schut, the mitzvah, and it's a cyclical mitzvah. It never stops.
I actually have the great merit of having created a fund in my father, Tzal Ben Avram's memory, and also together with my uncle, David Simons. And I get every year a report
of how that money, how many people's hands it's passed through, and the magnifier effect is just it's an incredible thing.
So that thing that I was talking about, you're involved in it?
I am involved in it, yeah.
That's amazing.
It's a very simple thing to do. It's a very simple thing to do.
That is amazing.
And it's important to me to stress that the idea of interest-free loans was one of the central organizing factors of Jewish communities. You can still see it in the Haredi world today, that as still living so many of the traditional structures, that it's not a given that the giving of loan to someone else is an excuse for you to make money. Because you said, you know, you might think you'd lose money off it. You don't lose money. And the sages spend a lot of time and spill a lot of ink to differentiate between what lost potential profit and what actual damage is. And that's one of the problems that we have in our mindset today, is that if I'm not profiting, I'm losing.
Right.
Right? So you asked me originally, what's the vision of this parsha economically? There's another side to it, which I want to touch, which is the difference between ownership and what we call usufruct. Right, ownership, private property ownership of land means that this piece of land is mine. And I can do with it as I will. I own it in perpetuity. Right, as the Torah says, "It's mitut." Right, and yet one of the central, most powerful lines that is in the entire parasha is that you shall not sell the land in perpetuity, ki li kol haaretz, because the land belongs to me.
And
says
you
God.
are residents with me. Yeah. I'm the real resident. I'm the boss of this land, and you're actually my guest, even though it's your land, but it's really my land.
No, but not guest, and that's what usufruct means. God gives over to us.
What language is that in?
It's a legal language. The difference between private property ownership, outright ownership, and the ability to what's called alienate property, or usufruct, which means that somebody else actually owns the land, but I have the entitlement to the usage.
Right? So they said today, access trumps ownership.
Well, that's in its own particular realm. But here, there are two different systems of relationship to land, which extend back through human history. And here is something which, you know, many American Jews may be surprised that we associate with Native American stories when we were growing up, right? Right, the white settlers that came to North America who bought the land and didn't realize that they were dealing with people who didn't think of land ownership in the same way. This is the Torah's image. Who owns the land? Only God. You have an inheritance, you have an inherent connection to the land. That's Am Yisrael, for sure. But if I sell the land that is my inheritance to someone else, they don't actually own it. They own a certain number of years of its usage.
Right.
In the same way that God says, and also I don't really own it. I own its usage through my life, and I have the privilege to pass it on to my children, but it's not mine.
Right. That's a very deep aspect of this Torah portion, which is that God's involved here. He's in the story. And our law has to reflect that. Our thinking has to reflect that. And I would like to bring it also to the place of when you follow God's dictates about the land of Israel, you will prosper. Yes, you will. Let me tell you a little story. Right before the evacuation of Gush Katif, of the communities in Gaza, there was the banks stopped giving loans to farmers. So we were involved in this free loan enterprise.
Mamin Vizorea,
which means has faith and sows. And basically what happened was that farmers got a massive loan from private people. It was a fund that was created. And it was you return the money if everything works out well. And if it doesn't, it was a gift. Now, I spoke to a traditional farmer. She was a pickle farmer. Her name was Lawrence. And she was a pickle farmer. And she said to me, Yishai, I must tell you, I remember how she told me, she said, the pickles grew this year, this crop, in a quarter of the time, she said to me. Now, this is not a head-covering religious-y woman who like talks in these kind of things. She said to me, listen, I'm telling you, something was weird. The pickles grew in inordinate speed, and they became ripe in inordinate speed. She said, I think it's because of the prayers of people to want us to succeed here. And I said to her, maybe this is the first time that you got a free loan and not a bank loan with interests, and that you were plugging in to the secrets of how actually economics works here in the land of Israel, which is different rules set out in the Torah. And that, yes, there's a lack of profit, as we just talked about, seemingly with no interest. But no, there's a different kind of profit. There's different kinds of systems. There's different kinds of blessings, economic blessings that happen here if you follow the Torah.
So now's the time then to really strengthen people's commitment to Israeli agriculture. There's a lot of talk in the news right now about the collapse of Israeli agriculture. And It's really important. I know that many of the people listening aren't actually here in the land of Israel, but to keep your eye out to buy produce that's produced by the Jews in Israel, to think about the free loan societies that are out there in the wake of the last Shemitah cycle. There's been an effort to continue the support to farmers who are committed to farming the land of Israel in the Torah sense. It's really a very important value that keeps us rooted here.
A person like yourself and myself, we believe in an armed Jew, in a Jew that fights back, certainly. But you also, and I've, you know, if you listen to my show, I talk about it all the time, how important it is to be able to defend yourself and to fight and to pick up arms and to be that Jew, that strong Jew. And yet I firmly believe that there's alternative systems to defense here in Israel, to keep the laws of Shemitah in this land. It says to you, if you don't keep the laws of Shemitah, you will be exiled from this land, because the land will reject the fact that you did not honor it and give it its Sabbaths. And also coming to Jerusalem three times a year. The Torah says if you come to three times a year to Jerusalem, nobody will covet your land. Nobody will want your land. And that's that. These are very important principles that the Torah tells us how to really be rooted in this land.
Absolutely. And, you know, to defend oneself, you have to have what to stand on. Right? And I think that that's why so often the image of the Jew in Galut is one who can't defend himself. It's not just simply a legal or technical issue, that if you're going to push back against the forces in the world that are attempting to knock you off base, you have to have what to stand on.
All right, Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you very much for helping us to have what to stand on. Hashem has given us this land back, and it's the maturation of our people now and understanding what we're doing here, a kind of awakening from a deep slumber, which has to happen right now. And I very much appreciate Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer here at the Yishai Fleischer Show on the Land of Israel Network. Please write me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And any questions, comments, marital advice, or other things that you want to hear from Rabbi Mike Foyer, write me an email. I'll forward it to him immediately. And it's great to hear from all of you folks. All right, so stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, stay rooted, and stay part of the story. Rabbi Mike, thanks again.
My pleasure. Good to see you.
Shabbat shalom, everybody. Stay tuned and shalom.